The Commission on Equitable Housing and Development meeting has now commenced. It is December 8th at 4 p.m. This meeting is being held virtually due to COVID-19 to allow for social distancing and protect the public health. As we continue our efforts in meeting remotely, we ask all commissioners and guests to mute yourself until called upon to speak to avoid feedback and background noise. For those who have dialed in using the call-in number, to unmute to speak, dial *6 on your phone. Also, prior to speaking, please announce who you are to identify yourself. As a reminder, this meeting is being recorded. We ask that you only use the chat function to request to speak or to announce that you are leaving the meeting so we can track quorum. Also, to comply with state open meeting laws, attendance and votes will be done by way of roll call using audio, not by using the chat function. So let's go ahead and do roll call. Michael Edmonds.
I am present.
Sharia Jimenez.
Here.
Jim Toffel, I'm here. Liz Wilson.
I'm here.
Jay Young.
Here.
Mindy. Mindy.
Here.
Bernstein. Lori Mazurbo.
Here.
I almost called you Mindy Mazurbo, but I knew that didn't sound right. Joanna Carr. I think Joanna emailed me. Ken Brianna Washington. Maggie Amato Tejas. Wendy Asher. Okay. Marianne Beerling is absent. Mark Clark.
Present.
Vicky Casino. And Olga Flores. Okay, Joanna Carr just joined.
So we've Jim, got... Vicky is joining. Betty is ill. And Maggie is out of the office on vacation. And Kieran will be late.
Okay. Yeah, I think Marianne's on vacation this week too.
Correct. Okay.
And our ex officio, Marcos Ismail.
Present. Good afternoon, everybody.
Marcos. Okay. And did you say Betty is out? Betty Villegas?
Yes, she's not feeling well. And
okay. And Liz Morales is out along with Ann Chenaka and Corn Manning.
Present.
Okay. Okay, so second agenda item is a review of the adoption of the November 3rd meeting minutes. The meeting minutes are posted on our website. I looked through them. I thought they looked good. So are there any modifications to the November minutes?
Jim, I did not go to this. I haven't read them. If you think they look good, I think they are. But having not read them, I don't think I can approve or not approve.
Okay. Does anybody else have see any changes or adjustments to the meeting minutes? All right, then without
Sorry, Jim, I have adjustment to the meeting minutes section. Item number 9, EV readiness. It says that a discussion was held it was to table the motion. Okay, apologies, I misread.
Yes. Okay, then without objection, the minutes are approved. Now, we do not have meeting minutes for September or October. Nesto, do you know what?
I don't have an answer to that. I'll get you one later.
Okay.
I've also been requesting the July meeting minutes because the Housing First subcommittee made adjustments to their goals. So I'd like to request that again, please.
Okay, will do, Liz.
Okay. Okay, agenda item number 3, the call to audience. This is the time when any member of the public may address the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development. Due to time constraints, the total time allocated for this is 15 minutes. Individuals are allowed up to 3 minutes each. Due to open meeting laws, Commission members cannot discuss topics that are not on the agenda. Items brought up by the public may be considered as an agenda item for a future meeting. So is there anybody who would like to speak? We have Joe Adino.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, great. I just wanted to take a minute real quick. I'm sure we'll go over it in the subcommittee updates, but just a thank you to Joanna Carr for her presentation to the Housing First subcommittee on some tenant protections last week. It was really good. I've felt like that's a conversation that should have happened a year and a half ago as the commission started up and hasn't happened. And I've been persistently disappointed by that. So it was really great to have a discussion about those and a real rundown of what's being done in various places, what people think are good ideas. And I really hope in the coming months that this body can forward a roster of recommendations in those areas to mayor and council for approval. So thank you all. And thank you, Joanne.
You're welcome. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Is there anybody else who would like to speak? Okay, we're going to move on to agenda item number 4. This is a discussion on the housing bond election in Flagstaff. My understanding is that the city of Flagstaff, this last election, passed a housing bond. If you all recall, we made several recommendations to mayor and council last month on things that could be done to improve the amount of affordable housing in Tucson. One of those items was to direct staff to look at putting a housing bond on the ballot and what that would take. So Sarah Darr is joining us. She is helped put together, my understanding is, Sarah, you helped put together the bond for the city Flagstaff. And so she's going to kind of talk us through how Flagstaff went about it and just help us educate. So welcome, Sarah. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's an honor to share with you what we were able to accomplish. I'm not a Zoom user, so I shared my screen and things moved. So now we're back. Okay. Thank you for your patience as I navigate through Zoom. Again, my name is Sarah Darr. I'm the housing director for the city of Flagstaff. I've worked for the city of Flagstaff for over 22 years in the housing field. I haven't always been the director, though. I started out managing CDBG and then created our land trust program, et cetera. So I'm going to share with you not only this effort, but we had a previous one and what didn't work with that one. I know that if Flagstaff is not unique in many of the things that I will talk about, please know that when I'm speaking of them, I'm not assuming that you guys are any different, that we all share common challenges, especially living in the regulatory framework in Arizona that we live within. So I'm glossing over a bunch of items, leaving plenty of time for questions, prepared with additional information depending on which direction your questions go. I'm entirely open. I'm happy to answer those questions at the end of the presentation, and hopefully I'm helpful in some way of you guys moving into a similar spot. So thank you. We've started some public education with this slide here. It's not a new issue for Flagstaff. This is an image from a paper in 1910. Coconino Sun is Flagstaff will need 100 more new dwellings. So when the community says, well, what's changed and why now, we really worked to frame this as this is a long time problem and the reasons have changed or the needs have changed. But in reality, our housing needs date back. This helped overcome some of the old timer anecdotal information we would hear from folks of like the back in my day, we didn't need housing. And to be able to say, hey, you know, it is a longstanding problem in the community. It hasn't impacted everyone equally. So giving that history and background, I'm going to share with you a little bit of our local data so that you have the framework of what we're working on. So we started publishing an info sheet a couple years ago in partnership with a local nonprofit. And so we updated this for the bond. So our 2022 median sales price was $615,000. Now we're up right over $700,000 in some areas of the community as a median. So prices are yucky. That's the official term. Increase in area median income at the same time that housing prices went up 166%. Our increase in area median income only went up by 36.5%. And then an increase in fair market rent for two bedroom. We use fair market rent, but as I'm sure you're familiar with, is that number is 2 years behind. It's a HUD number. We use it for consistency because we can show how rents have climbed. But you would be hard pressed to find a two bedroom in Flagstaff for that $1,400, $1,500 number. It would be a steal if you were able to do it. We also did an analysis of our cost burdened households, and a total of 45% of all of our households are suffering from a cost burden. Of course, with that being higher on the renter side at 57%, and only a quarter of our homeowners being cost burdened in our community. Something somewhat unique about Flagstaff is I call it our tween challenge, is we're too big to be small and too small to be big. So we're in a rather awkward spot. By federal definition, we are a metropolitan area, but by the state definition, we're rural. And so while we are metropolitan, we only qualify for CDBG dollars. We do not qualify for home or ESG. We only get in CDBG, we get about $550,000 or $600,000. So federal money flowing straight into the community is not prolific. Many of our programs, and that's outside of the Housing Authority, of course, but many of our other housing programs are general funded, and that's depending on the availability of general funds. During the Great Recession, we eliminated a few programs because there just wasn't money, and we're just now almost back to the funding levels that we were pre-recession. It's hard to have programs that are only budgeted on a one-time annual basis. It's hard to maintain that momentum, not knowing if it's going to be there the next year or not. So you can see our population, our MSA population, which is all of Coconino County. By the way, Coconino County is just a bit bigger than Pima and Maricopa counties combined, square mileage wise, but 66 of the county population is in and around Flagstaff. So something we work to educate our counterparts back at HUD is that the distance and size to our surrounding communities, because it's not pull a contractor from a neighboring community. We don't really have neighboring communities. We are a Sky Island. So our population of our surrounding areas, you can see, is quite a bit larger than our in boundary population. Those housing needs, of course, extend outside of our municipal boundaries. Something else I know you all are very familiar with, but this is something that we have started utilizing this report published by ASU in order to educate the public better, because it's the questions you know you get as well. What about, and why don't you just require developers to do it? Why can't we have rent control? Those types of things. And so we started a different conversation with the community through a planning process I'm going to talk about in just a moment, to really educate the community that our rules and regulations in Arizona are different than where their sister lives. And so to be able to open that conversation, maybe someday moving towards legislative change, but at least working with an informed population was really helpful in this effort. And our city council declared a housing emergency in December 2020. This was in response to a citizen's petition, because in the same year, earlier in the year, council had declared a climate emergency. And all kinds of emphasis was being placed on our climate needs and climate change, et cetera. And a citizen said, well, even more boots on the ground wise is housing. So brought forward a citizen's petition, council directed staff to draft a housing emergency, which really guides our internal focus and funding to also look at housing as a priority, prioritizes the housing work program when it impacts other departments, and prioritizes internal funding when it's available. So of course, there's no one solution, and it's a resolution. It's not binding, but it was a declaration. And one of the things that it asked for was a single comprehensive community-facing document to summarize our immediate and long-term needs with strategies. I was privileged enough to do a presentation at the Arizona chapter of the American Planning Association conference this fall with your very own Anne, where Anne talked about Tucson and what they just did for their 10-year plan, and I talked about what we did. We took different paths, but I believe ended up in very similar places. So we have some momentum building with the housing emergency and then the 10-year plan. We had a massive public participation process, including working groups that involved both members of our housing commission and public working groups. We did a fairly in-depth citizen survey, which brought forward some pretty fascinating information, and then a quantitative needs assessment and spit out a number of what we believe the market has not kept up with in comparison to population growth. Of course, nearly impossible to quantify the demand other than the demand we see with growing prices. Council approved this plan only in February of this year. So to me, that feels like a lifetime ago. So much has happened, but it was just in February. One of the pieces that really resonated with council and the public coming out of the housing survey done with the 10-year plan is that a little over 58% of Flagstaff residents stated that they were either nearly certain or somewhat likely to relocate due to housing costs. And I just found a typo in the slide. My apologies, I copied and pasted and clearly didn't edit well enough. We had over 3,200 participants in the survey, which was massive for a community of our size. And this statistic really stuck with people. What would Flagstaff look like if 58% of our residents left? And we have a transient nature of our community with NAU being up here. So I'm sure you're aware of the situation around U of A with people moving in and moving out. NAU makes up a massive part of our community. And so it impacts really our entire community with the transient nature of that population. And then to have our working population also in a transient situation is pretty scary. So one of the goals in the newly adopted housing plan was to create a dedicated funding source. So it helped writing it into the plan, lots of public participation. This came from our public working groups, which I was happy to see. And in the plan with a short-term implementation piece. So there's a little bit more momentum. One of the things that we've talked about with our community and we integrated into our education surrounding Proposition 442 is that local money means local rules. Because we have so little federal funding flowing directly in, and we are limited in our general fund capacity, we don't have a lot more doors to go knock on. For state money, we compete with the rest of the balance of state. Every area outside of Pima and Maricopa, we compete with, and our costs are higher. So if they do a cost benefit, you get more units if you build in another spot than you build up here. So this was important for our community to also be able to make rules about how those funds are spent. So Proposition 442 is not the first run we took at this. We took a run in 2018 with 422, which took me a long time to get my 442 and my 422 worked out. 2018, Proposition 442 passed by fewer than 3%, or did not pass by fewer than 3%. The exact number is 747 votes. That one lives with me. There's a couple reasons why, or things that we believe impacted, is that the council direction to do this was received in late April, early May, and May to November was not a whole heck of a lot of time to put something as large of this together. There's all kinds of internal reasons that that direction was received late. Other items had received council direction in the fall, and so we were really behind the eight ball. There was also divided council support. It was a 4-3 decision. It's hard to go talk to a community about a bond measure when even your council was divided on it. Citizens felt the proposition was vague and lacked accountability. I totally agree with the vague. We had very little time to write it, so it was written really broadly as we're going to do things in this range. And as far as lacked accountability, there was an oversight body written into the bond language, but there were all questions about, well, who would be on the oversight body and what would it look like and what would their responsibilities be? And then many citizens misunderstood the tax implications of the bond. So both into 2018 and in 2022, we are staying within our current tax rate, but we have available bonding capacity under that same rate. And so many people, because we did not have adequate time, in my opinion, to do the in-depth community education that was necessary, folks really believed we were placing things up on top of what they were already paying, instead of that the liability had decreased so we could use that credit card balance, if you will. And then the common conversation of, why me? It's coming out of secondary property tax. So why should I be paying? I already have my home, that type of thing. So there are a number of things that changed between 2018 and 2022. One, it was 4 years, felt like two, welcome to the pandemic. But we started work on bond recommendations in 2019 in preparation for 2020. Council also established a housing commission. We did not we had a housing authority board, but we did not have a housing commission. So we now have a housing commission that was created in late 2019. They started meeting at the beginning of 2020 and had two in-person meetings before the pandemic hit. That was fun. Oversight and accountability, the creation language and the ordinance for the housing commission specifically mentions responsibility of oversight of any funds approved by the electorate. And then, as you'll see in a minute, the Housing Commission created very specific bond recommendations and predicted outcomes. So the 10-year plan was approved, and we're working on our incentive policy for affordable housing. Also pretty impactful is a growing community interest and understanding of the challenges. It wasn't only staff anymore, or one or two nonprofits that continued to talk about it. There was a growing community interest. So why did the Housing Commission make bond recommendations? Well, because City Council asked them to. They tested the newly formed Housing Commission with creating recommendations for the 2020 election. And they did. And we went to Council on March 3rd with those recommendations. Between March 3rd and the next Council meeting was when the world shut down. And the Council discussion was, now is not the time to have any items on the ballot in November, and so was postponed. So these are my little COVID viruses for you. So in 2021, Council then requested a review of those 2020 recommendations because we'd made them in preparation for 2022. So that was early 2021. Bond possibilities were presented to Council in June of 2021. And then we had the 10-year plan approved. And then in November of 2021, the Housing Commission had refreshed and reapproved the bond recommendations for 2022. So what does that look like? Housing Commission worked on it 2019 through 2022. Then Council created a Citizens Bond Committee to review all the recommendations, which I'll go over the categories next. Council discussed the Citizen Bond Committee recommendations on June 7th and then put it on the agenda on June 21st for this November's election. There were two bond questions totaling $77 million and change. The housing bond question was for $20 million. Our city council was faced with some difficult discussions. I think this is one of the reasons that we saw the Citizens Bond Committee created, is that they were presented with a massive list of community needs. You can see all the areas here. The ones in blue are the ones that ended up in some form of funding within Proposition 441 and 442. There were not easy decisions to be made. All of these groups had the opportunity to present to the Citizens Bond Committee, which then resulted in recommendations going to City Council. Here's what our Housing Commission came up with for recommendations. I promise you I'm not going to walk through every line. I'm just going to point out that the top EH is emergency housing. We had the recommendations were for two things in emergency housing, three things in rental, and three things in ownership. The things in green I will talk about next. Those are the things that council ended up putting on the bond. The commission wanted to give a shopping cart. Council, here's what, if you ask us for less money, if you say we're not doing $50 million, what will that look like? And as you can see, nothing goes away. That was very important to our housing commission, is that within these recommendations, they are all important. They cover the housing continuum from homelessness to homeownership, and they are all important. Nothing went away if the funding amounts decreased. Of the categories that council ended up, based on recommendations from the Citizens Bond Committee and then council analysis, was redevelopment of housing owned and managed by the city. This would be for RAD. I believe you guys are within the RAD process with your own housing authority as well. Incentivizing the private sector to incorporate affordable housing rental development through the creation of a revolving loan fund. We've done some revolving loan funds with our own money in the past, and they've been successful. Acquisition of property in partnership with private developers to adaptively reuse available property for the creation of affordable rentals. And then home buyer purchase assistance loan program, which would also be revolving. We have a long-time general funded down payment and closing cost assistance program that can go up to 125% of area median income, because we've recognized that need. We can't do it with federal dollars, so we've been doing it with local dollars since the late 90s, with the exception of the Great Recession. We lost that program during the recession, and it's coming back. You can see council landed on $20 million. For these items, which is in between, if we excluded all the other items, it's in between Housing Commission recommendations 3 and 2. So it's, some members of the Housing Commission were disappointed in the lower money amount of $20 million for housing. I happened to not share that disappointment, because I know how long and how hard we had worked even to get to this point. The previous council, when we were looking at recommendations for 2020 and at that March 3rd meeting, were pushing for a $30 million number. But of course, those discussions were never finished or compared to the other or combined with the other needs within our community. So Proposition 442, titled Creating Rental and Home Ownership Opportunities for the Residents of Flagstaff. This is the actual ballot language. That's why there's a weird question mark at the end. This was the logo developed for us to move forward. We did so in partnership with the other bond measure, which is on our next slide as well, having to do with wastewater, wildfire engines, and flooding, which our community is suffering due to our wildfire situation in recent years. So actual ballot language, we went together. We did everything together. In 2018, we did not. In fact, the transportation group that was moving forward with a ballot, a measure at that point in time, we couldn't even, according to them, we couldn't even share a flash drive when we were doing community presentations. Housing was 100% separate. That made it way harder. I felt like the redheaded stepchild going into the rooms. It was difficult when there's this, they had more money allocated. Our materials were black and white. Theirs were color. Those little things, when you're handing them out to a room of people, tend to make a difference, at least on initial appearance. So a copy of the rack card that's on the left-hand side was in the materials provided previously. You can see how we shared the education opportunities. They were going for $57 million. We, of course, did our publicity pamphlet. We had a website and the QR code. If you had a chance to look at the video that I forwarded, those are all hosted there. The QR codes we put on everything, which reduced the number of words that we felt we needed to use, because people could go get more information pretty easily. We did the info sheets and the videos, which I had sent links to. We did outreach to community groups. In 2018, I think I did 78 presentations in 4.5 months. It was exhausting. It was pre-COVID. We took a different tactic at this point in time, where we sent kind of our media packet, or here's all the information, to the community groups and said, if you would like a presentation, we're happy to schedule it. But we also recorded the lengthy presentation. There's a 20-minute video and then shorter videos targeting each proposition and what general obligation bonds are. So we did limited in-person presentations this time, which I don't know how to value that. Last time we did so many, and this time we didn't do nearly as, I think we did 4 or 5. And this time we passed, last time we didn't. What was the impact of that? It's hard to say, except that in the presentations previously in 2018, I would notice a momentum. Someone who wasn't necessarily in favor of what was being presented would speak up, and it would kind of be a snowball rolling down the hill as people were like, yeah. And it didn't matter that I said, well, that's not quite how secondary property tax works. Let me explain it. It was not a fun time. We had open houses. I put this in quotes because we didn't do open houses like we've done previously, where we have them at a city facility or a county facility and people come to us. We tried to go out into the community and go to people at different times of day. We had one at a locally owned coffee shop. We had one at a locally owned brewery. We did a lunch and learn where people could come, and this one was at City Hall. Bring your own lunch at City Hall or attend that one virtually. And we had 3 people come to the coffee one in the morning. One of them was a reporter who was there to talk to the citizens that were attending the event. So I'm going to say 2 because the other one was a reporter. The brewery one, we had about 6 folks, but there were other people around that we could share information with. And then the lunch and learn, we had 1 person attend remotely and we had 1 person in person. And the 1 person in person was a student who works for NAU's newspaper. So last time, 2018, we had a lot more community members show up, but they were the ones that were coming with specific questions in mind. We didn't know quite how to value that this time. Is do people feel educated? Is the information available for them, and so they don't feel the need to come seek it out? Is it because of COVID? Did people just not care? It was hard to determine before the election what the value of those were. If I had to do this again, I would still have opportunities for the public to come talk to staff, or staff to go talk to the public. I liked going out into the community where anybody could come or where they could encounter us. I don't know why they weren't so well attended. I like it to think because we did such a good job educating in advance. So community dynamics also changed. There was a political action committee this time. There was a small one last time, but because of the late to the gameness of the whole thing, it was not, I don't want to say very powerful. There wasn't much impact from the political action committee this time. It appears to have been pretty prolific. I have stayed as city staff, not being able to advocate. I stayed completely away from the yes on Prop 442. I only looked at their website today, putting this slide together, because I didn't want to watch the community argue. I didn't want to go through that. So I saw when I got a flyer in the mail from them, I saw some ads in our local newspaper, but I also stayed off of social media during election time. It's not good for my mental health. So, but this was their statement. And as you can see, they latched on that. What would the community become if 58% of our population moved away? That 58% slide we used in our housing commission materials, in the citizens bond committee materials. And it looks like this group latched on it as well. They had video testimonials from local folks. They had written testimonials on their website. And I do know they had some activities out in the community, like First Friday Art Walk. But I was actually pretty shocked today when I got on their website to see all that was there. So I'm guessing that this had a decent impact. But again, I don't know. So here we go. Proposition 442 approved. 63.39% of the vote. Proposition 441, which ended up being the pumpers for wildfire, some flood remediation and planning, and then a lot of funding for our wastewater treatment plants, which are outdated and are, thank you for the little celebrations on the screen, that's fun. Our wastewater treatment plants are old and are undersized for a community of where we're growing. And so that one passed with 76% of the vote. So we weren't up at the 76 point, but I don't think 63% is so bad, especially given that 747 in 2018, which I took as a we don't like the details, not this is horrible. So that is our passing. And then what now? Well, now we have a 10-year plan to implement and programs funded by 442. I'm going to be requesting a staff member, a new staff member during our budget process, because our lift just got a lot bigger, not only with the bond, but also with the 10-year plan implementation. So my contact info is right here. My email address is there. I'm happy to share a phone number if that would be helpful for anybody. But Tucson staff also has my contact info. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Sarah, if you'll stop the sharing.
Yes, thank you.
Actually, can we share for a minute? Because I actually have a couple of questions about a few of the slides.
Sure. Let me figure that back out.
You know offhand, so I'm gonna kind of rapid fire here. Do you know what the area median income is in Flagstaff for a family of four, say, or
I sure do.
Person.
It is one of the. Darn it. I'm trying to share my screen again. Apologies for my clunkiness with this. Our area median income, I have pulled up on a different screen. I want to say we're right at 63.
For a family of four?
Yeah. Do you have another question I can answer while I dig that up?
Yeah, if we could go back to a couple of the slides. So the 20 million, is that a per year number? Or is that total over 10 years?
So the 10 years is 10 years is the 10 year plan. It's not relevant for this piece, but it is the total over. It's the total for us to spend. So with bonding authority, it's available. I could have $20 million tomorrow if I could spend it. Of course, we won't pull it down because we don't want to pay interest on money that we're just sitting in the bank. So we'll pull it as we need it. And I figured it out. Thank you for being patient with me. We'll pull it as we need it. Did that work? There it goes. So I'm paging through the slides. We were going 20 million. Close your eyes. Apologies. So that 20 million is broken out here in our publicity pamphlet. We did not specify these amounts. We specified these amounts in the publicity pamphlet. We did not put these amounts in the ballot language itself. So these are now guiding numbers. They are not, it's in the ballot language, and therefore we cannot change it without going back to the voters. So we kind of straddled the line on that one because it's housing and housing changes, and sometimes housing changes really quickly. We did not want to be bound to something if home buying becomes absolutely unrealistic in our community. We did not want to have money sitting there that we cannot spend without going back to the voters. So that's how we kind of split the baby on that one. They're guiding numbers. That's what we talked to the public about, but we were very upfront with saying about or estimated or we anticipate.
So with these revolving loans, so like RH2 is a revolving loan. What are the terms on that? Is that something that it become? Is it a lump sum payment at the end of like a 15-year period, or is that paid throughout the affordability period? Or do you?
Sure. So we've done this with general fund money in the past, where we've partnered with tax credit developers with a local contribution or with land. The structure we've had in the past, and of course we haven't set this entirely up yet, but what we've done in the past is a simple interest only payment for 15 years with a balloon due at the end, so that those tax credit properties can cash flow. And we're still realizing some, but then the balloon at the end. And they are cash flow loans. And so any money that can't be paid due to cash flow on the property, those interest only payments gets tacked into the balloon payment at the end of year 15. Will we do it that way? I don't know. We haven't examined those details with the Housing Commission and Council, but that's the concept that we've implemented in the past. And we have several of those on the books with general fund dollars.
That's a really smart way to do it. So there was one thing you said that piqued my interest, and that was on the roles and responsibilities that the commission had.
Mm-hmm.
Can you go back to that slide one more time?
I sure can. So our commission.
The oversight and accountability. There you go. You just passed it.
Did I pass it?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. So the language in. You know what? I had this slide in there and I deleted it, so I didn't have too many slides. The language in the ordinance that created the Housing Commission, we have a 13-member Housing Commission with members in specified categories, and then one member that serves on both the Housing Authority Board and the Housing Commission, so that we have continuous representation and communication between both. The bond language specifies that this body has responsibility for oversight of any funds approved by the electorate. What does that mean? I'm meeting with the attorney's office next week. So we know what it means. Council's ultimately responsible for oversight of the dollars. They are the ones who have to approve the issuance. They're the ones that have to approve the expenditures, et cetera, the annual budget with the bond funds in it. They will receive recommendations from the Housing Commission. We will report out to the Housing Commission more frequently than we will to City Council. We'll be issuing an annual update and report to the community. We're planning on updating the Housing Commission. In the beginning, as we're getting things rolling, it will be much more frequent, but ultimately we anticipate twice a year. Things in housing land, as I know you know, monthly reports don't make a lot of sense. So we're working on this project, and now we have a nonprofit partner, and now they're working on it. And those updates aren't always super meaningful in a shorter time frame. So we'll be working with the Housing Commission on programmatic details, of course, then taking to council for final approval, anticipated approval. Of course, they don't have to, but that is Council was planning ahead and thinking where were our weaknesses. And I don't want to pat myself on the back, but staff too, as we were writing that, I'm like, hey, can we tack this in here so that we can address some of those things we knew the community really struggled with? As you can see, some of the momentum in the other pieces where it's a goal here and then we put this in here really solidified it for us.
Well, Sarah, congratulations on getting this passed. This is a tremendous accomplishment, and I'm very happy for you. So, and I really appreciate you presenting this just because this is something we've been talking about. So, let's go ahead and I'm going to open up for other members. Mindy.
I did find our AMI. AMI at 80% per family four is 68,700.
68,000.
68,700 for a family of four at 80%.
So just for reference purposes, the city of Tucson's is about 42.
Okay.
Our issues that we have in Tucson are very different than Flagstaff. Our median rents are lower, but our AMIs are also significantly lower. So we have a similar issue here, but it's got different drivers that are causing it.
Yeah, ours is really a supply and demand. And the fact that we're surrounded by national forest, we can't sprawl. So we have to go up. And when our community doesn't want tall buildings, we have a 60-foot height limitation. So we're really in... We're in a weird spot. We have a, I sometimes call them a schizophrenic community. They want infill. They don't want sprawl. But when you bring in something tall that's infill, they're also upset. So my parents are some of those people. That's why I feel so free to speak about those opinions.
Okay, Mindy?
I'm sorry. I'm having a moment of reactivity, Sarah. With some of the language that, Sarah, you just used about a schizophrenic community, it's...
Apologies if it offended.
Can we get a copy of your presentation?
Sure, I will be happy to send it.
Thank you.
Is that it, Mindy? Okay, Shay?
Yeah, I was wondering a few things. One was, what was the final tax implication on, you know, the property owners? And then kind of along with that, you know, how does that translate in dollar amount to someone who is paying property tax? And how did you get the sign? I mean, to me, the big political lift here would be getting property owners to agree to bear that burden. Versus doing something like a citywide sales tax. We had this, I'm just curious how you all got the sign off for that, because it does seem to, in some ways, I could see politically how some people would feel singled out maybe with that kind of arrangement. So curious about how all that worked.
Sure. Great question. Thank you so much. So this was... Let me go up a little bit. So our current tax, this was all staying under our current tax rate. Let me scroll a little bit so you can see the bottom. So this was our current debt issue, was at $46 million under our current tax rate. The orange is what has been authorized in the past, but has not been issued yet. There's a couple of projects that are authorized that are still in planning stages. The $70 million was what was estimated would be asked for in November 2022. And that our future election capacity, that still leaves us $50 million as we hit over on the right-hand side. So that is without changing the tax rate. That is what people are paying now. Our community has a habit of making much larger payments than required and paying down debt earlier than predicted, which has opened up this capacity to be utilized. And so in talking to the community and talking to the Citizens Bond Committee, we were really talking about people not paying more than they're paying right now. Due to Arizona law, we still must talk about it as a tax increase, because hypothetically, if this wasn't there, the amount people are paying would go down. In reality, it wouldn't go down for several years because we continue to make larger payments, so we pay less interest. That's better explained by our finance guy. But that's the gist of it. Here were our residential taxpayer impacts at various different levels. So it's a planning purposes overall, a 20-year debt issuance at 5% interest. Which way do we look at? Is it 10? We gave estimates for 10, 25, and 70. You guys can see my screen, right? Yes. Okay. And then our basic class three residential assessed value at 287. Planning on 0% growth, knowing that's not realistic, but it makes it a comparable across. The total rate stays within our current rate of 0.80. So for here are the tax implications across the three categories. So the residential annual impact was about $154 a year over 20 years, just over 3,000. So we were able to talk that through. We also did commercial estimates as well. And you can see the annual commercial impact would be about 277 with a 20-year impact of about 5,500. So that is how we talked to the community. We didn't, not it's so much in our outreach materials, but in the Citizens Bond Committee. And if anybody asked those questions, this was the information that we had available. Again, if you look at the materials from the Political Action Committee, it says without a tax increase. That was their choice of language. We were advised that under state law, it is a tax increase. It's phrased that way, but it really isn't resulting in any additional tax dollars showing up on tax bills that weren't already there because we were using existing capacity. Did that answer your question?
Liz?
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. And congratulations.
Thank you.
Awesome.
So I wanted to ask if you have information on the demographic difference between renters and homeowners. In Tucson, I think it's 45% of our population is renters, 55% is homeowners.
Our breakdown is about 50-50, plus or minus 2 percentage points for over the last 20 years. So that's, it's ebbed and flowed somewhat. Our community used to be upset about such low ownership rate. However, remember when homeownership was a big deal 10, 15 years ago, and homeownership rates were growing and they represent stable communities. And we did some research and showed that in mountain university towns in the West, we're right on. Those homeownership rental rates are about 50-50. So if you compare us nationally, you compare us to Arizona, it's low. But if you look at comparable communities with similar demographics, it stays about 50-50.
Thank you. My other question was, you mentioned that there's no ESG funding in the city of Flagstaff. And I was wondering whether any funds from this proposal would go towards emergency shelter services or even hotel vouchers in any way.
They do not.
So what does Flagstaff do?
Well, we compete for that money through the state. So our nonprofits apply to Arizona Department of Housing to receive that funding. So we are not receiving it directly. We are not allocating. Is it flowing into the community? Yes. Do we have control of it? No. And so our nonprofits compete with all areas outside of Maricopa and Pima in order to receive that funding.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Great questions.
Jay?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I've got a few questions. I guess I'll kind of take them in order I think that they should go. So what do you think are the most important initial steps to get the ball rolling? Is it community buy-in? Is it, you know, professional expertise, understanding what the housing needs are? Like, what do you think it really needs to go first in order to pull something like this off?
You really have easy questions. One, I think the political climate was really important for us. When we did not have unanimous council support, it was easy for people to say no. It was easy to pick apart and pull apart the details. And so I think that the support of our elected officials was critical. I also think having additional folks in the community, our Housing Commission members, who were educated on the topics, who knew how to talk about them, so that when they encountered folks who said, well, did you know that this is what's going to happen with the money? They could say, actually, here's some materials. Let us share with you how that works. So I think the other thing that added to us was the public participation plan process that came with the 10-year plan. So we were harnessing some existing community momentum surrounding those. I think one of the things that made the biggest difference this time is how, this is horrible to say, but how bad it's gotten, where now, I mean, it's not just the statistic of how many people are leaving. Our employers see it all the time. And so we've seen it for a long time, but then coupled with the hiring and retention difficulties that came post-COVID, I think really, really emphasized. And some members of our community talk about in Flagstaff, you can survive, but it's hard to thrive because you can do it, but you're not really saving much. You're not really, you know, there's the college fund is spare for your kid, that type of thing. So, and that homeownership is so far out of reach for so many people in our community that it's just not even realistic. So I would say the community conversation and the support of our council.
Okay, thank you. If you had to identify the strongest group, or I don't know how you want to characterize it, where was the most pushback when this kind of started up and it didn't go so well? What was there a particular constituency, or were there multiple, or where was the biggest pushback?
In 2018, it was the business community led by our chamber. I would say that was a huge piece. Some of the most hostile audiences I presented to in 2018 were homeowners associations. There was one where I went and sat in my car afterwards and cried because they were so brutal, not only with their questions, but accusatory statements. And so that was the biggest pushback. This time, the biggest pushback, our chamber this time around came out with a no position. Which was fine. So I wouldn't say we got a lot of pushback. I was super apprehensive going into election day because we didn't have a massive outcry. There may have been on social media. I did not get on social media and read that. I didn't play in the comments. I didn't. The detractors in the news articles about the bond measures were traditional arguments surrounding no new taxes, no property taxes. Why should some pay for all, that type of thing? So I would say this time around, we didn't have a massive outcry from any one group in particular.
Do you think that the first question and the second question, do you think that what changed really is just how bad the climate's gotten? Because 2018 and 2022, though it's not that many years, it's a pretty different situation. Is that the main thing that changed, where business just saw that, you know, in order to actually be in business, they need workers, or, you know?
I wouldn't say it was the main thing. I would say it's definitely a contributing factor, but there was a criticism in 2018 that we didn't have a plan. And while we do have housing plans, we have multiples. They go to the state, they go to the feds, council talks about them. We did not have a plan. And so I think now the criticism of, well, you don't have a plan. Well, we do. And the bond items in the bond measure answer things identified as strategies in the plan created by our community. I would say it was some of the groundswell of the public knowledge and participation, also driven by how bad that it is getting. Yeah.
And then my last question is, do you think that the bond as it passed address the actual needs, or do you think it hit 50%, 75%? Like, where did it actually land? And then, you know, based on all of that, what are your main lessons learned?
It doesn't address the need. It's a drop in the bucket when we look at what we need. And the Housing Commission was very smart in their creation of recommendations in that emergency rental and ownership. I think part of the explanation dollars not going to homelessness is that the solution to homelessness is more housing. And there was a focus on the creation of rental units. And so rather than dollars going to programming for a shelter, they're going towards creating additional rental units. That was part of the discussion of the Citizens Bond Committee and City Council. We do have a quantifiable number of our missing housing units. And we also quantified our number of households that need affordable housing, households that are either living in overcrowded conditions, are housing cost burdened, are homeless, et cetera, not homeless, everybody that is in housing but needs it to be more affordable. So we had those numbers to fall back on as well. So it's a drop, but it's a start. The other conversation was, we have a lot to prove. So you're going to give us a little bit and then see what we do with it, and then give us the opportunity potentially in future years to go back. It's going to be a number of years before that happens. But I am excited to see where we get to before I retire. So
thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the questions.
So Sarah, before I call on you, I made a mistake on something I said earlier about Tucson's area median income. I was going off of memory. So that the number I quoted for was for an individual versus a family of four.
Okay.
So the area median income for a family of four in Tucson is actually about $61,000.
Okay.
So it's not as stark of a difference as I was thinking originally. Apologize about that. So Sarah?
That was all. Thank you, Jim.
Are you going to say that? Did I steal your thunder?
Yeah, you did. It's good.
Hi, Sarah.
My sword than you need it. Yeah. Okay, Shay?
Yeah, I'm also wanting to know more about the marketing piece and the sort of PR campaign that you all had. That to me seems really strong and seemed like it was strong the whole way throughout the process. Did you all have to ask for money for that? I mean, how did you all go about kind of putting that together? Did you have dedicated people who were on that? I mean, it just seems like it was a ton of work.
It was a ton of work. And money. We did have I haven't been going through the chair. I apologize. Is that a habit here? And Jim, I should be going through you, chair.
No, no, you're good.
Okay. All right. I just realized. Thank you. We did have an outside consultant team. We ended up using our in-house people to do the bulk of the materials. And so the video creation, the consultant teams advised on some content and some election theory, but it was really our in-house marketing team that put the videos together, that put the fact sheets together, that did the logo. So we did have a consultant. They were more useful in the beginning as far as quantifying community perceptions, et cetera. But as we got into materials, it was really our in-house team. And I don't know if you had a chance to watch the little video. Comparatively to the proposition 441 is real people. Ours is a little animated one. We were cautioned to not, because we can only function in an educational capacity, not in an advocacy capacity, that we should stay away from the pulling on the heartstrings, that this is Sarah Dar and her family of three, and this is what it looks like, and here's what they can afford, and don't you wish. We left that to others in the community. We stayed really just the facts so that there was less to challenge on. If you look at bonding, there's certain categories that cover like streets and parks and utilities. They're all in one bond category. And then there's everything else down here, and we fall into everything else, as do all the sustainability initiatives. And so not a lot of folks, especially in Arizona, are doing what we're doing, and we don't have a lot of money. And so I've always taken a very conservative perspective on, I would rather be very careful with what we do than spend money defending a lawsuit that we overstepped. And so not that y'all are familiar with any of those concepts at all, I'm sure. So we also are looking at your source of income ordinance and are watching very carefully from a distance. So thank you for taking steps into that area as well. We are excited to watch you do that as well. So.
Okay, CJ.
Sarah, thank you so much. This has been extremely helpful. I have a couple of questions, and they're a little bit just clarifications because someone else asked a very similar question earlier. When you were just talking about the work you did in-house, I just want to clarify, that's within the housing department or just within the city of Flagstaff?
Thank you. Within the city of Flagstaff, we have a conventioners and visitors bureau who has a marketing piece to it, and they were able to take our concepts and turn them into what you saw as final products. So no, we don't have, we've got a pretty thin staff.
And who is that? The visiting bureau? That's
convention and visitors bureau. Yeah. Okay. All those pretty pictures you see of flag that say Discover Flagstaff and our leaf leader and all those things come out of that department.
Interesting. Okay. And then you had mentioned, so when you were talking about doing this outreach, you sort of answered this question that you weren't in a position legally to do any kind of advocacy for it. That was purely educational, so people understand what it is they're voting for. Mm-hmm. And that was done by the housing department, or was that a different department?
Oh, no, that was done by us.
Okay.
So, and previously we'd done all the presentations. Media requests were handled by me in conjunction with our PIO. And PIO for the city, not for housing. So it was a staff carry. It was not a consultant carry.
And that happened. So I just want to make sure I get the timeline right. That was happening once it was already established that it was on the ballot. And so throughout the sort of the election process, that was still HCD or your housing department was educating folks on it without advocating for it per se.
Yeah, we carried it all the way from educating the commission through recommendations, educating Citizens Bond Committee. It was a staff lift. Consultants were not for us. They were for city election overall.
And then sort of a related, just follow up on that. So, I don't know if you know this, but so I know that there was sort of this firewall between what the city is doing and what the PAC was doing. Do you have a sense of when the PAC was formed and how long they were involved in the process?
I can email that answer. The only reason I know is because I'm on a mailing list of housing advocates in the community. Yeah. And I received information and had to reply and say, please remove me from all communication. So I want to say they were really pushing us for information late July, early August. And council was coming back into session in August. And we wanted to run things past council before and get their head nod on things before we released to public. And so I would say formation probably in June, July is my guess. Council didn't put it on the ballot till June 21, although it was anticipated that there would be something for housing on the ballot. We just didn't know the details. So it was a late summer creation of the PAC, or at least as they were gathering information.
And then last thing, just real quick. I appreciate what you were saying about being really conservative with the idea of there being potential legal challenges. Am I understanding that so far have there been any legal challenges, or do you anticipate still some legal challenges at this point?
That was me knocking on my desk very quickly. There have not been. Okay. I don't want to say yet. I have heard no grumblings of them, but we are a month away. Approval was a month ago today.
Right.
And so.
Right.
Is it coming? Maybe. Will they come maybe when we create a program and somebody disagrees with the details? I don't ever assume we're in the clear with those things, especially in the state that we're in. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Mark, did you have a question or comment?
My question was answered.
Okay. Anything else before we let Sarah go? Okay. Again, Sarah, thank you so much.
Did he freeze for you guys too? Okay.
It looks like our chair and our co-chair are not.
Oh no!
The internet.
I should be here.
Oh, okay, great, Mike. We take.
Yeah, I was trying to give Jim's packets a chance to catch up, but let me just take another peek at his screen real quick.
Oh, there he went.
Yeah, he's off. Okay, all right. Let me switch over then. As Jim was saying, thank you very much. And I will try to move forward. Are you going to be able to hang around, Sarah, or do you have things to do?
I can hang around if you would like me to. Either way.
Okay. I don't think it's necessary, but I just wanted to ask just to see.
Okay.
Give me a chance to come back. With that, I guess we're really done with item 4. So, okay.
Thank you so much.
It was all right with everyone else. I believe we can safely move on to item 5, discussion of city bond election. And that would be CJ Board, Ward 3 City Council aid, and 15 minutes. CJ.
Thanks. Just to clarify, I am not here on behalf of Ward 3. I do work in Ward 3, but this is my own time. I work with a couple of groups that are looking to forward this sort of thing here in Tucson. SAPA, that Jay Young is also a member of here, and then Tucson Alliance for Housing Justice are both interested in bringing this, what they accomplished in Flagstaff to Tucson. I don't really have a lot to say. I talked to Jim about putting this on the agenda, and then in the meantime, came to understand that last time y'all had already recommended something like this for Tucson. So one sort of question I have maybe for Neto is, are those recommendations on their way to council, or sort of what happens next in terms of that becoming a thing that the council is being, you know, recommended on?
They were forwarded to the mayor and council.
Okay.
I don't know the status of them at this point.
Okay. So the one thing I wanted to share really was just having spoken a little bit with Sarah last week, and then coming up with some similar numbers in terms of the tax impact on folks here in Tucson. And I know I had spoken a little bit to Jim and Shay about this in a different meeting, and I was really uninformed still about what the tax impact would be here in Tucson. I can share that if that's helpful. I don't have a full slideshow. It's one image that sort of breaks it down similarly to what Sarah did for Flagstaff, but here in Tucson on a couple of tiers of housing.
Available. I'd like for you to share it.
Yes, please share. I would love to see that. And who, where is this information coming from, CJ?
This is from, one second. I want to make sure. Is this it?
I think Ernesto, do you need to give him some authority to share?
Yeah, hang on.
Okay. I was trying to do it without the authority. That's what happened. Shay, to answer your question, I spoke to a woman named Joyce Garland, who is the director of business services for the city of Tucson, and she sort of ran the numbers. I want to say that one thing that makes it tricky, and y'all probably got a sense of this from Sarah's discussion, it's not a really straightforward answer the way we would love it to be. It'd be nice if you just say, oh, this amount, it's going to be this amount in taxes, but it really has to do with the fact that we're paying off things as time goes on. So this year is different than next year, and that's different for next year. And if somebody runs a bond 3 years from now or 4 years from now, then that's going to have an impact. And so it's not as static a target as would be nice in terms of the soundbite. Let me see. Am I good to go, Neto?
Yes, you are, CJ.
Okay. Sorry, this is sharing in seminar mode is very different than sharing otherwise. I'm not really seeing.
Not at the bottom of your screen there?
No, I can hit share screen, but then it's very strange. I hit share screen and normally I would just, it would let share the screen, but it gives me all these options. There's like 13 options of what I want to share, but I can't see any of what they are. So,
well, while we have a moment, I'm going to hand the gavel back to Jim and just let Jim know that CJ is speaking on behalf of himself as a citizen, Jim.
Okay.
Just pick one, CJ. We'll see what happens. It'll be fun.
Yeah. Are you seeing this? Are you seeing anything now?
No.
Have you been made a panelist already? Would that make a difference?
No, he's good to go. He's a co-host as a panelist.
Okay.
CJ, if you have an option that says screen, choose that one, and then it will share and follow you wherever you go.
It's
usually the first option.
Is whiteboard? Does that mean anything? I've never used that before.
Yeah, that's not what you want.
Yeah.
So usually screen is somewhere close to whiteboard.
Yeah, none of them say screen. There's a base. Sorry, y'all. Let me try this. Second camera.
Now we see you.
Oh, great. That's not helpful. Let's see.
CJ, do you mind me asking? What are you trying to show us? I don't think I understand.
Sorry, say again.
I don't think I understand what you are trying to show us.
This is just, it's a similar slide to what Sarah had in terms of the tax impact on different level of properties. I could also read it to you, or I could put it, I could maybe, wonder if I could send it in chat.
Just so everyone knows, that was in the an information packet. I think I understand what you're here. We all should have it in our email somewhere, by the way.
Right. If that's, yeah, I mean, basically, I'm happy to proceed, but it's for some reason the sharing thing is not working. I had hoped it would.
So, CJ, I'm sorry, I just tested it. When you hit share, if you have that, there you go. Oh.
Is that someone else doing that?
Maybe.
Okay, perfect. Well, that's the thing that I was looking for. So, you've done it.
Yeah, and, I did this. This is what you want.
Perfect. Yes. This is just a basic, I asked, business services to run the numbers similar to what Sarah did for, and I gave business services, a copy of what Sarah sent us and then just said, can you do this for Tucson? But keep in mind, I think the thing I didn't really get until her presentation was the idea is to keep the tax rate actually even and have it not constitute an increase. And so to do, and that's something, I just wasn't getting before. And so you still have to legally talk about it as an increase because it's more than you'd be paying if this wasn't passed. But the idea is to keep that rate level and simply have a chunk of it be going towards this. Any questions about this?
I have a comment, please. This is Vicki. Just thank you for the information and I appreciate the visual, but I have made this request of this commission in the past to share only accessible documents. And this was sent as a JPEG. It is not accessible. And so I am publicly asking again what we are going to do as a commission to start to make materials accessible for everybody. I mean, we are a commission supposedly focused on equity.
Okay. Are there any other questions? So I guess I have one question, CJ. I mentioned this to you the other day that I thought that all of the property taxes went through the county. So would this be a an adjustment to the county rate that would then be delivered back to the city? Or what are the mechanics of the city doing a property tax?
Well, so the city is able to do what's called a secondary property tax. And this is why what's great about following Sarah, it's exactly what they did. This doesn't have to do with the county. The county also assesses a property tax, but this is a secondary. It's just for city residents.
And does the city currently have a property tax of any sort?
Yeah, I believe so, but I don't know what that is currently.
How is that assessed? Because I get my yearly assessment from the county recorder's office for our property tax. How is that assessed each year from the city? Is it done through the county, or I'm just not clear on that.
I don't really know the answer to that. Sorry, Jim.
Okay. Shay?
Yeah, so what was the lump sum? Like, this is assuming how much was borrowed.
Oh, good question. Yeah, so this is a number that I got early on without fully understanding what some of what Sarah just put out there. But so at the maximum, there are $4.9 billion of taxable property in Tucson. And at the maximum, that would generate $294 million over the course of 10 years. Now, part of what I got from Sarah's presentation is that that is going to depend a lot on if this is something that council moves forward with, there's going to be decisions made, and they may not go for the maximum. They're not obligated to do that. So that's in a world if that were pursued, but it could be anything less than that as well.
Yeah, it seems highly unlikely that we would max out our credit line, basically. I mean, yeah, but
well, keep in mind, but again, the way that I don't want to speak to whether it is likely or not, because I have no idea in terms of the political will there. But keep in mind that doing the maximum now doesn't max it out for 10 years. It's each year it's a different amount, right? And so you've got, as other things are, other bonds are being paid off from the city, then I really like that image that she showed with the different colors, and you can kind of see how it slopes down over time, and some, it can be a gradual slope or it can be a more, sharp slope, but that does change over time. So what is the max for this year is different for next year and the year after that.
Liz?
Yeah, thanks so much, CJ, for putting this together and going over it with us. I just have a couple questions. So I know that this would be a city property tax, and I think I'm just not quite understanding how there's not going to be a tax increase if currently we don't have any information about the city of Tucson's property tax value as assessed, and if there's no relationship kind of being leveraged between city of Tucson and Pima County regarding that tax rate. So I'm just curious if that's something that's going to be considered.
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely does need to be considered. I'm just being straightforward. These are questions that are in the very early stages, and just sort of saying, we know that Phoenix is working on one and that Flagstaff just passed it. What do we need to do to get the ball rolling so that Tucson has something similar? But yeah, these more intricate questions about tax, I mean, will absolutely have to be part of the conversation. But I just want to be clear, I'm not an expert at all in taxation in the city or anything like that.
The only reason I express that concern is just because of my professional experience working for the judiciary. I did, over a series of several years, watch people lose their homes as a consequence of back taxes. And I would hate for this to generate more homelessness or lost property, just because there is a statute in the state of Arizona that a business or an individual can just purchase someone's back taxes and then own that parcel of land. So that's my concern.
Mark?
So used to know a fair amount more about taxes, property taxes, than I used to, or that I do now. But generally, yes, the city has both, I think, general obligation and revenue bond capacity. Revenue bonds have to be paid back out of user fees, I think. The tax bill that we all get from Pima County includes county taxes, county property taxes, city property taxes, Pima College, the fire district, if you happen to live, and other special taxing jurisdictions that you may live in, or that you may, that your property may be located in. So I would say that it can be a little confusing. And if we're going to talk seriously, I would suggest that somebody from finance probably should come and do a presentation on property taxing, the property taxing issues, because they are complicated. I mean, we heard some of that from Flagstaff. The issue about, you know, adding new bonds as old bonds paid off. The city's, I believe, been doing that for quite a while, so that the rate doesn't go up. But again, you have to go to the voters and you have to tell the voters it's going to go up. So it does add a little bit of confusion to communicating about the taxes, about the bond issue.
Thank you, Mark. That's helpful. So just from a time perspective, we've got 50 minutes of items left on our agenda. We've got about 35 minutes. So I'd like to kind of get this wrapped up, but I do want to leave everybody with a final thought that the more and more the way that the affordable housing programs, specifically the low-income housing tax credit program, is set up, is that they want to leverage their money against other outside sources. And this would be a considered an outside source that would be leveraged against the low-income housing tax credit. And because it's a competitive process, if we don't do something, but Flagstaff's doing something and Maricopa Phoenix is doing something and the other jurisdictions are doing something, it's going to put Tucson in an even more difficult situation to compete for those dollars. And so I do think that this is important to at least make an attempt. I can't say that we're going to get it passed, at least the first time, but I think there's a lot of political goodwill right now to do something like this. And it is something I would like for us as a commission to continue to work on and help with. But the initial recommendation that we made to Mayor and Council last meeting was that they direct staff to start evaluating this. You know, so I think we need to continue to push that. That's my two cents. Jay?
I agree with you 100%, Jim. I'm just wondering, since this is such a complex issue and I think is, you know, one of the most important things that we could recommend as a commission, though, I mean, we already have to a certain extent. I'm just wondering if we might come up with some next steps about how to keep this ball rolling, whether it's, you know, more information. Obviously, there were a lot of questions here today. You know, I think it might be good to, you know, think about creating a more detailed recommendation for mayor and council as well. I'm just kind of thinking out loud here, but I don't want this to kind of drift off our agenda and, you know, a couple months down the road be like, oh, right, the housing bond thing. So I don't know what y'all think about next steps, but I just want to throw that out there.
So here, I'll just put on the table. Here's what I was thinking is on agenda item number 7, communication with mayor and council. What I was really hoping we could do there is each of us pick a council member, and over the next month, we try to have a sit down with each council member when we talk about, you know, what the commission's doing. We can talk about this bond initiative specifically. And I think the other important thing to bring up is the housing trust fund, is for the city to get the housing trust fund going again. And those two things will have a significant impact on on our ability to do affordable housing in Tucson. And it, part of that is going to be to listen as well to our council members on what their agenda items, what they think we should be talking about, what questions they have. And then, you know, I think I'd like to come back together as a group and kind of and vet that out. But that's what I was thinking would be the next step is to get those communications, see if we can get something passed by mayor and council to say, yes, this is something that we want to see move forward. So they've got to make a motion. They got to pass it and get HCD really working on it. I think that's what we have to do. Cause if they don't direct HCD to do something, we're dead in the water. We can't get this thing started. We can't do it ourselves. Liz?
I'd like to request that the next step kind of be getting some more information on these tax specifics from the Pima County Treasurer, just so that we understand kind of what the breakdown is of county taxes. And then after we have an understanding of those Pima County taxes, which I think are the biggest burden that people are experiencing, it might be a good idea for us to look at those city taxes that are currently in effect on property.
Okay. Marcos, I don't know if that's something you might be able to help us with or at least point us in the right direction.
Possibly. And Liz is right. The bulk of the county, the bulk of the property taxes levied by the county go to the county, but there are, there are pieces that go out to all the local fire districts, school districts, the city of Tucson, and, possibly some of the other jurisdictions. You can look at your tax bill and get an idea, looking at your personal tax bill if you live in the city. And get an idea of where the money's going. And I'm not sure who, I guess I could try it, on reaching out through the assessor, right? I'm thinking the treasurer.
The assessor.
I can see what we could do. The assessor's been doing a lot and becoming we've got a new assessor and she's a lot more proactive than the previous, so it's a possibility.
Thanks, Marcos. Mindy.
Thank you. I have relationships with Steve Kasachek and Karen Ehrlich. I would not be comfortable going on my own. I feel very, I'm quite not fluent in this arena, this book we're talking about, but I would be happy to, after we get more information, if there's somebody who would be willing to go with me, I'm happy to go. But I couldn't speak. Y'all are just so eloquent on all of these issues, and I'm not up to speed on that. And also, Vicki had brought up about accessibility. I know that we haven't addressed that because we're in the middle of this conversation, but I don't want to see that disappear for her sake, and that disabled community that needs to use other alternative modalities to stay informed. Thank you.
Okay. Jay?
Just a couple more things. I think it's a great idea to touch base with city council members, but I do think, really to Mindy's point, we at least need to have some sort of framework of what we're talking about. I mean, are we going and asking them, hey, what do you guys want to see? What are the issues? Or, hey, we're the housing commission. Want to talk about these five things we think should be on a bond? I mean, I think there's some details to work out before going out and talking to council members, though I think it's a great idea. The other thing, you know, just thinking back to the presentation from Flagstaff, you know, another central piece it sounded like was community input, right? I mean, there was a 2018, people were like, hell no. And then, you know, 4 years later, it passed. And, you know, I think things changed, the environment changed, right? The housing market changed. But, you know, that community participation piece and what folks in the community are saying and supporting is going to be critical. And, you know, one of the things that we haven't had a lot of as a commission is a lot of public input. So, you know, I don't know if we want to start as a commission inviting other folks, other organizations, whoever, to come in and speak about issues, because I think that that's going to be a critical piece. At least it was in Flagstaff, because I'd hate to see, you know, a strong opposition to this when, you know, clearly it's needed in the community. So something that we want to think about getting out in front of as well.
Shay?
Yeah, I had similar comments. You know, I don't want to go talk to anybody until we have kind of a more united front, more clarity on what we're asking for. I don't know how critical it is that we ourselves have the details figured out. The other piece that stuck out to me in the presentation was that there was a bonding committee. And to me, those are the folks that would ultimately handle the particulars of dealing with the tax, you know, implications and tax law and all of that. But I imagine we have something similar. Betty Villegas had mentioned there was a bond attorney involved for the last time that the Pima County housing bond got passed. So having that person, again, just that authority in the room who understands how to do these bonds, and what we're allowed to do, because that was another huge piece with the last bond that got passed. They went through several ordeals where at first they were only approved for infrastructure funds. And then later. So again, I think we need those people in the room, and we need to understand the full, all the implications of what you can even use the money for. So they had to go through a process even to get, basically get housing itself approved to be funded. I don't know who that authority is and within the city umbrella, but I imagine that there is someone who is the bond expert within our jurisdiction.
Marcos.
Shirai is right. The city has a bond council. I'm not sure who it is, but yeah, they will have one, and it would just take a matter of reaching out to find who that is. You know, I'm not sure which department, either city finance or city manager office, would be able to help direct you to the right person. And you know, and they're going to be able to speak to, as you mentioned, the uses and the intricacies of you know, how to go about, you know, aligning a bond ordinance to meet the needs of what you want to accomplish. And what we found is it all boils down to the wording of the ordinance. And so a lot of thought needs to be put into that. And so that would help there.
Okay, CJ, and then we're going to move on.
Yeah, I realize we're over time, and I'm going to keep it really brief. But I just want to say, so when I got curious about this, and I reached out to the city manager's office to say who is the authority on bonds, the assistant to this city manager sent me to Joyce Garland, who I spoke to about this, that said that she is the sort of the authority on bonding in the city, and that's why I spoke to her. And then I just want to keep folks in mind and sort of, adjust to what is within your scope and what isn't. I think that right now I agree with Jay that you maybe need to like talk more about what exactly your game plan is in talking. But I know that in months past, folks have brought this up. Like, it's one thing to say, okay, these are our recommendations, but I think doing a little bit of lobbying on the things that you think are most important is really powerful. And it's not too hard if you write to, you don't have to have a personal connection to present or past council members to do that. I think if you write to the ward office, you will generally get that. I mean, it's a compelling thing, right? And so just to do that is my recommendation. And then, you know, once the ball gets rolling, I think keeping an eye on it, and if you pay attention to it and you see something transpiring you want to push back on or that you want to encourage, that can be an ongoing thing. But I don't think this body is going to be the one that writes the language or that provides, you know, fundamental oversight in that bond. I think here it's more of just your role is to simply be one of the voices to push for it to happen, to start to get the ball rolling, and then keep an eye on it and make sure it's advancing in a way that you think is equitable.
Okay, let's move on to agenda item number 6, the subcommittee updates. First item is housing segregation, and Jay, you've got the floor.
We have not met recently, but the next time that we meet, we will be getting a report from city staff about what the city has or has not done in the past several years regarding gentrification and displacement. So we're kind of waiting on that and have had a couple of issues meeting. So that's all for us at this point. And I hope to have a report about our meeting at the next meeting.
Okay, thanks. Housing First, Liz.
Like Joe mentioned, Joanna did a presentation regarding tenant protections throughout the United States. It was, I think, extraordinarily productive in terms of conversation and also us getting a kind of framework and baseline to get the best tenant protection plan we can. There's been ongoing communication between Joanna, Ernesto, Joe, and myself on basically opportunities to integrate these tenant protections in a way that doesn't open up like legal liability or preemption in any way because of the Arizona Landlord-Tenant Act. So we're going to be taking a closer look at that. Something I also mentioned at the meeting was that I very unexpectedly have to move out of state. This is actually my last like 12 days in Tucson. So I mentioned that the bylaws probably do exclude me from participating in the commission going forward. On the one hand, I'd like to continue to participate. On the other hand, I will no longer be a resident of Tucson, and I don't want to be representing our community if I'm not a community member, and I'd rather open up my seat to someone who could fill it in that capacity.
Liz, where did you say you're moving?
I'm moving to where I'm from in Texas.
Oh, you're moving out of state.
Mm-hmm.
Is your place still going to remain in Tucson?
I'm sorry?
Is your place of business still going to remain?
I have no place of business. I'm a student.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So I want to let you all know that if it's decided that I have to resign, this is the last time I'll be seeing you in this capacity, but I'm still a researcher at the university with Mapping Racist Covenants. So I am still actively contributing to Tucson's housing fight as best I can. And that's it for me.
Liz, I'm sorry that we're going to see you go, but I wish you the best in your endeavors, and hopefully, you know, given that these are online meetings, you'll still come and visit us occasionally. Check in.
Does she have to go? Can she stay on for her term?
I believe the rule is you either have to be a resident of the city or your place of business has to be in the city. That's why I asked her if her place of business is in the city. So
do you want to set up shop in my backyard? Just like a little...
I have nothing to offer at this point. I'm merely taking things in and doing what I can with them.
Okay. Well, thank you, Liz. Thank you for your service on the commission and participation. You've always had, I think, really good comments, have been constructive, and I really appreciate all that.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, affordable housing, Shay.
Hi, yes. it's all a blur to me. Sorry, I've been in and out of town, so I'm pulling up my notes here. Thank you, Liz. Also, you know, it's been great having you here, and you will be very much missed. So thank you. But we were mostly spent most of the time talking about the 5-year affordable housing goal. I'm trying to, Jim, I'm going to have you help me here because it was mostly.
I can't help you with this one. I missed this meeting.
Oh my gosh. I'm trying to remember. There was some specifics we went through. Ah, that's right. So the main point was I shared, yes, I remember it's coming back. I shared the some of the data that Jim had about really just showing kind of how many projects are in the pipeline, affordable housing projects. And then, you know, just mostly looking at kind of, we're trying to solidify a number, right? So how many, what should be our target for how many affordable housing units we should be able to be producing in a year? So we kind of went back and forth and it was just one conversation. So I, you know, we looked at it from, you know, from the work that Jim had done with like the sort of the affordable housing world and people who are nonprofit, for-profit or nonprofit developers who are doing that work. But we also kind of looked at just what the regular market is doing. And Marcos had some great data from us for us as well as what, you know, just how many housing units is Pima County producing just in general, you know, just in the private market. So between those two numbers, we kind of we set a goal for 2,500 units a year, which is more than we're producing now by a lot. And so I have so many distractions right now. Sorry, my house. So that's where we're at right now. So the 5-year housing goal, 2,500 times five. That's I'm going to do the math really quick here. 12,500 units in 5 years, which is ambitious. I think it's ambitious, but we also, we were trying to find that sweet spot between something that's doable versus, versus just staying the same with where we're at. So, there's good discussion on that. And then Marianne talked about a model in the Port of Cincinnati. The Greater Cincinnati, Port of Greater Cincinnati had a model where they're basically buying land. Their housing authority was buying private land, taking it off the market and trying to build their portfolio of city-owned land. So, that's what we discussed. It was a lot now that I'm remembering everything. I guess what I'm unclear about, even during the meeting, we didn't take an official, we didn't vote on this. So, I don't know if that needs to happen here or we haven't quite solidified. In my mind, the next steps aren't clear.
My suggestion is let's get the subcommittee to pass a motion that they can bring before the full commission with a recommendation and then we'll address it at this level. I suppose we're trying to vet it out here.
Yes, agreed. Thank you, Jim.
Okay, any questions for Shay or Jay or Liz? Okay, very good. So I'm gonna blow through this next agenda item number 7 here pretty quick, which is the communication to Mayor and Council. Ernesto, do you know if the letter that we approved last week got sent?
Jim, I don't know. I asked Ann, and she is out of the office today. She'll be back on Monday, so I'll get an answer for you next week.
Okay. So the letter that we all approved last month to Mayor and Council was basically a summary of some of the things that have happened, including the source of ordinance, the source of income ordinance, the parking reduction, the impact fee waiver. Those are all very great and positive things. And then we had four additional recommendations. And the first one was to reestablish the housing trust fund. The second one was to direct development services to review and change zoning regulations in order to encourage affordable housing. The third was to direct staff to evaluate the potential of adding an affordable housing bond or tax measure to go to the voters, which is what we've been talking about today. And then the fourth was to enact a fast-tracked approval process with development services. And so the thought that I had in going to Mayor and Council was, these are the four talking points. These are the things that we've agreed on as a commission that will require a motion by Mayor and Council to direct staff. So right now, these items, for the most part, are in the HAST plan, but they're not being addressed or they're not being worked on because Mayor and Council has not directed staff to do it. So it's a fairly, I think, simple ask. And then it's listening. And I'm going to stop sharing so we can see each other. But I am happy to participate in any or all of the meetings for individuals who are not comfortable with it. But I think it would be my goal to have each of us participate in this. So is this, I guess I'm going to put it out for a question. Is this something that you guys want to hang on for another month before we do, or is this something that we want to try to accomplish this next month?
I don't necessarily think it's reasonable to accomplish it in the next month just because the holidays. And also I think it might be useful for us to have like talking points regarding each of these topics so that we don't go in and say like, I support the housing trust fund, but I don't necessarily know why.
I'll tell you what then, let me take a crack at that. I will try to develop maybe a 4-slide presentation or maybe 5. Maybe we'll do one of this is what's happened. And then 1 slide for each recommendation with a little bit more information on it. We can try to get all of our ducks in an order, and then maybe after our January meeting, we can move forward on this. I'm good with that. So is there any objections to that? Okay, good. So it's 5:55. I wanted to try to get this EV ordinance that we tabled last month. So does everybody have a little bit of extra time to go through this? Are we short on time?
We still have quorum.
Well, okay. So Corin developed a short presentation for us to give a little bit more information on the EV ordinance is that was passed by Mayor and Council. So,
Corin. Can you guys see my screen?
Yep.
Okay. Last time we discussed this and we maybe didn't have all the details at the time that would have supported the conversation. So just wanted to provide a little bit more background about the EV ordinance and what it does. So basically the EV ordinance has been adopted by Mayor and Council, the EV Ready ordinance. They adopted it in August and it actually went into effect December 1st, so just about a week ago, meaning that all new commercial development that includes multifamily as well as retail and office is now required to provide EV infrastructure for a certain percentage of the parking spaces that are provided on site. And there are requirements for stations, outlets and conduit with the idea that a smaller number of stations or outlets are required today. And over time, that conduit will allow for more stations and outlets to be brought online as we see greater adoption of electric vehicles. So, not letting me advance. Happened the last time I tried to share in Zoom. Hold on just a second. Hold on just a second.
Try hitting down arrow on your keyboard.
Can you guys? Okay. Are you guys still seeing my screen?
Yeah.
Okay. I had it in presentation, but I think that actually wasn't showing up. So these are the, this is what we mean by stations, EV installed stations. That's where you can actually like, you know, it's sometimes from Blink or some different companies that provide those stations. EV ready outlets are just outlets that you can plug into, and then conduit or EV capable is just simply conduit. So it's a little bit of the definition. The regulations, as I mentioned, went into effect about a week ago. So all new development now must meet these standards. The highest requirements are for multifamily. That's because most people want to charge at home. So one of the main goals for this ordinance was to bring these resources to multifamily, to renters, to tenants who you know, need to rely on their landlord essentially to provide this type of infrastructure. There's also requirements for office and retail, but they are kind of scaled based on the anticipated demand. There's also some incentives in place. So for example, the baseline requirement is a level two charger. Where level three chargers are provided, there can be some reduction in overall requirements. There's also some parking relief. If you provide more EV infrastructure, there can be overall parking reductions. And I did want to note that this is meant to be compatible with our existing ADA parking guidelines. So 4% of the EV charging spaces must be ADA as well. So just an example of a multifamily site, what this would look like. So if you had a building, an apartment building with 19 units, you have 20 parking spaces overall, you would be required to have two parking spaces that have EV outlets, and four additional spaces would be required to be equipped with EV conduits so that they could be EV spaces in the future. That's how that would look for a multifamily of that size to meet the 30% requirement. We did look at cost estimates, what the impact of this would be as we were developing this ordinance. There's quite a range, and it really depends on a lot of different site-specific conditions. But you can see here kind of the range per space for multifamily and what the overall project cost could be. There are some current incentives from TEP. They have the Smart EV Charging Program, and it does provide some financial incentive for multifamily and other types of sites. So what Jim brought to the commission last month, and I think we wanted to discuss again tonight, was potentially requesting that mayor and council direct staff to look at options for some sort of subsidy for providing funding for affordable housing to help subsidize this additional cost of the new EV equipment, at least for some period of time as the technology kind of becomes more standard. This would mean looking at funding sources. There isn't a funding source in place yet. So exploring what those funding sources would be, eligibility, how we would evaluate this over time, and a potential sunset date, and other factors as well.
Thank you, Mark.
Jim, I'm once again willing to move that recommendation contained on the screen there.
Okay, motion's been made for Mayor and Council to direct staff to explore options for providing funding for affordable housing projects to subsidize the additional cost of installing the EV infrastructure. Is there a second?
A second.
Seconded by Jay. So I'd like to open it up for discussion. I guess, you know, we had a lot of discussion last month, you know, just trying to understand what it was. I was fairly involved in this throughout the the public meetings prior to it being enacted. So I felt pretty comfortable, but does everybody else understand what it is and now, and is this have a better feeling for it yet, Jay?
I was just going to say, I think this is critically important. I mean, the EV charging ordinance is already gone. It's already passed. Multifamily buildings are going to have to do this. And so asking mayor and council to figure out ways to make this less expensive for multi-housing construction is important so that we can reduce the cost of future multifamily housing. So it's not, I don't think it's a huge lift. I understand that last time there was some confusion and it was a little bit out of nowhere, I guess, with limited context, but, you know, based on the presentation today and kind of what we've heard, I think this is a really important thing for us to do.
Joanna?
Yeah, thank you. I agree. The presentation's really helpful. And just to echo Jay, I think like my understanding is that this has been passed. And to me, it makes sense to support affordable housing developers, in trying to find ways to subsidize and reduce that cost. So that's my understanding of it. And I'm in support of it.
Liz?
Thank you. Jim and Corn for putting this together. I have the same concern that I had last time, which is that any property managers who step in or property owners may pass the additional electrical costs to tenants. So I would approve of this as long as there were specific language regarding not increasing the cost of utilities or rent to offset those costs. So that's all I have.
So if I could take a crack at that one, the rents on most affordable housing projects are capped based on a tenant's income. And so if the utilities go up, the rent has to go down. My understanding is almost every affordable housing project out there, they look at the maximum rent as being plus utilities as being 30% of that individual's income. I think that is
true in my experience with people who are on housing subsidies. Increasingly, some landlords are starting to do something called balance billing with utilities. And that is a way that people are priced out in terms of utilities. And it doesn't violate necessarily subsidized housing rules and guidelines. So if it could just have some sort of specification that like community utilities aren't the responsibility of individual tenants, that like no fee would be assessed to individual tenants for in anticipation of community utilities, something like that, I think would be sufficient to protect tenants from any cost increases.
Okay, Vicky?
That was one of my concerns too, so I won't repeat it. Thank you, Liz. I would absolutely agree with that. And thank you, Corin, for all of the visuals and information and including the accessibility piece. I also just want to make sure that accessibility requirement gets carried through and isn't just part of the PowerPoint.
Oh, yeah, that's actually in the code requirements.
Mark?
My guess is, well, I certainly understand the concern about not passing on additional utility costs. My guess would be that will run afoul of the legislation which prohibits municipalities and other jurisdictions from regulating rent. So I think it will invite lawsuits and further legislative action.
Can I actually respond to that real quick? So that rent control does prohibit addressing rent specifically. So obviously landlord wouldn't be able to address the, wouldn't be able to adjust the rent rate. Or I should say we wouldn't be able to control the rent rate, but we can make, have specific guidelines and requirements regarding the assessment of fees. Right. And utilities are not related to rent. They're separate.
So Liz, I guess what I'm struggling with here is this recommendation has to deal with the upfront cost for installing the infrastructure for EV charging. And there's nothing in this or in the ordinance related to ongoing utility management or maintenance or how that's managed. I mean, I think that's, there's nothing in the ordinance that says how the utilities are paid for. I mean, my understanding is there's two options. Either if you have a charger, the person using the charger is paying for the electricity bill. If there is an outlet, the property owner is paying for the utility bill. And I guess I'm struggling with this being a reimbursement for upfront infrastructure costs, how that relates to the long-term utility costs.
So is there an expectation that it be connected to electricity? Like, I know that might be a dumb question, but I just want to clarify, like, is that written in the ordinance?
The EV chargers?
Yeah, the chargers must have power supply. As okay. Jim mentioned, it's silent on how that is paid for. That's something we don't regulate in zoning.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's appropriate for us to say that, like, city subsidies, it would not necessarily improve people's quality of life if they're priced out of a unit. So, I mean, I think it's appropriate to say where we think funding should be equitably applied.
Jim, can I?
Yes.
Well, I think to some degree these are they're related, but not really. I mean, the issue that I think I'm hearing now really speaks to the issue of whether there should have been a requirement to install these things, not the issue we're talking about in this motion, which is that we think the mayor and council ought to try to find a way to offset some of the installation costs for certain affordable complexes. So I mean, I think there may be a second motion that would be, that would speak to that, but issue, the equity issue of passing on or appropriateness issue of passing on charges rather than this particular motion, which is asking the city to explore ways to subsidize some of the installation costs.
Yeah, and if I could add a little bit of context to what Mark's saying, the reason that we're doing this is because part of when the ordinance was under debate, the argument I was making was that this is going to damage developers' ability to do affordable housing projects in Tucson. And it creates an unrealistic additional expense on those projects, which, you know, might mean they may not happen. So, Vicki? Okay, is there?
I apologize. I just forgot to lower my hand.
Lori?
I guess I just wanted to ask if there is a time frame for how long this is going to go, because I can't stay much longer.
Okay.
And so, I don't want to impede a vote.
I think, well, so I think we're almost ready for the call to question. Is there any other final comments before we put it to vote? Shay?
Yeah, I would just like to keep the motion as it is. Again, just not to further complicate the issue. I very much see upfront costs
associated with construction very different than long-term utility costs. I think those are two different motions and two different issues. So for now, I would appreciate just sticking to this motion as written.
Okay, so let's go ahead and call the question. So the motion is to recommend to Mayor and Council to direct staff to explore options for providing funding for affordable housing projects to subsidize the additional cost of installing EV infrastructure. Michael Edmonds.
Aye.
Sharia Jimenez.
Aye.
Liz Wilson.
Abstain.
Jay Young.
Aye.
Mindy Bernstein.
Aye.
Lori Mazurbo.
Aye.
Joanna Carr.
Aye.
Ken Brianna Washington.
Aye.
I think Maggie's still not here. Is Wendy Asher with us? Okay, Mark Clark.
Aye.
Vicky Casino. Oh, wait, Vicky's not here either. And Olga's.
Yeah, I am.
Oh, Vicky. I'm sorry, Vicky.
Aye.
Okay. All right. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8. We have 9 ayes and 1 abstain. So the motion passes.
Real quick, Jim, just to check with everyone. Kim Brianna has joined. Is she a voting member?
Yes. Ken Brianna, did you vote?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, oh, pardon me.
She did vote. She voted aye.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Corin. We appreciate your help with this.
I'm sorry, Jim. I do have to excuse myself, but thank you, everyone. Have a good day.
Okay. Thank you, Liz. All right. So Ann and Liz are both gone from HCD. So we're going to do...
Can you give me a minute, please?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be real quick. Commissioners, good evening. I sent to you today a follow-up to a press release that you should have received last week on the opening of the public housing waitlist on January 3rd. You should have received 8 visuals, 8 digital flyers in 8 languages, and we're asking that you, commissioners, through your personal and professional networks, help publicize the opening of the waitlist. Feel free to make copies and tack them on bulletin boards at your churches, at your grocery store. If you happen to go to a laundromat, spread it with your families, whatever you can do to help publicize the waitlist opening on January 3rd for a 3-week period. We'd greatly appreciate it. So if you have any questions, you can communicate with me later about this very critical step that the HCD is taking. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Nesto. Okay, next meeting is going...
I make one quick announcement as well, Jim. Yep. I just want to let everyone know, because we've mentioned this to the commission a few times previously, we've been working on an update to the infill incentive district, the downtown zoning overlay, and I want to make sure the commission's aware that this is going to Mayor and Council for a public hearing on December 20th. And one of the key changes that we're making to the infill incentive district is to create an incentive for affordable housing in certain portions of the IID. So that's an opportunity for public comment, either in writing or by attending the Mayor and Council meeting the evening of December 20th.
Thank you, Corin. Okay, we're starting to lose members. So we're gonna adjourn here in a minute. Next meeting is January 5th. And Affordable Housing Subcommittee is next week. So Housing First canceled the December meeting. Is that right, Jay?
The Housing First has canceled. I don't know about segregation.
Housing segregation.
I believe we have a meeting on the calendar.
Okay. One thought I had for agenda items for the next meeting is the equity study that was done by the students at ASU. Do you think that's something that we can see the results?
I anticipate that the results, the study will be done. The students basically have to get it done by the semester, which is almost over. However, I'm not going to be here at the next full commission meeting on the 5th. So I could, happy to pass that along to somebody else or do it at the following meeting.
Yeah, maybe we'll come up on the February. Okay. All right. Well, we're down to 8 members, so I'm going to go ahead and adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate this.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Exactly. Merry Christmas.
And Hanukkah.